broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
In the electric age, when our central nervous system is technologically extended to involve us in the whole of mankind and to incorporate the whole of mankind in us, we necessarily participate in depth in the consciousness of every action. It is no longer possible to adopt the aloof, disassociated role of the literate Westerner. Marshall McLuhan, in Understanding Media, The Extensions of Man, published in 1965. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Marshall McLuhan is arguing here that what he calls the electric age, that is, the age supplanting the mechanical age, is ushering in a new kind of collectiveness in the human family. He says the aspiration of our time, remember this was in the 1960s, the aspiration for wholeness, empathy, and depth of awareness is a natural adjunct of electric technology. And he was right for a while. The cool medium of television, for example, with its requirement for participation, supported a new era of collectiveness. Woodstock, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the woman's movement represented a new coming together. So what happened to the time of peace and love, the collective commitment to the growth and development of the whole community? What happened to McLuhan's cited desire for wholeness, empathy, and depth of awareness? Can we explain what has aided and abetted the advent of the tribalism we're now experiencing? McLuhan is right. The medium is the message, and the medium has changed dramatically and with global significance since McLuhan published his book in 1965. What has changed? Well, McLuhan's electric age has passed, and we are now engaged in a great cultural revolution that has changed everything. It is called variously the digital revolution or the information age. What is the breakthrough that has given us the information age? It is the development of digital technology that now gives us the capacity to collect, transmit, and store information in a digital format that can be processed with binary logic. This use of digital information and binary logic is what allows your computer to do what it does. The result is what you experience now every day as the information age. So what does this new technology mean? How pervasive is it? What is its impact on our lives? Can we say that the age of the cool medium, with its requirement for participation, is over, and that digital technology is a hot medium that, in McLuhan's terms, separates and isolates us? In our isolation and separateness, are we now, in fact, the medium of digital technology? My guests today are Don Rush, Adam Wood, and Randall Cohn. Don Rush is Associate Program Director, Senior Program News and Public Affairs at Delmarva Public Radio. Adam Wood is Chairman of the Department of English at Salisbury University and Chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure. And Randall Cohn, joining us today, is Associate Professor of Math and Computer Science at the university. We're going to tackle the information age, or digital revolution, in four broadcasts at the station this year. In today's program, we'll offer an overview of the technological revolution and its basic impact on our world. The second program will focus on technology and how it has changed our economy and the global economy. Then in the third program, we'll look at the impact of technology on politics. And then the last program will focus on digital technology and the future, where artificial intelligence might be headed, and how we might use digital technology to support public purpose goals designed to sustain and nurture human communities. So let's begin with our overview of this digital technology soup in which we're currently being formed. Don, Adam, and Randy, welcome to all of you.
Thank you, Brad.
Thank you. Thank you.
Don, let me begin with you. As a radio announcer and sound engineer, you experienced firsthand the advent of the digital age. Tell us when and how your work changed as a result of digital technology.
So when I began, we were basically analog in terms of radio and broadcast. It was very difficult to broadcast from, say, from remote places. You had to have large trucks. You couldn't produce things, say, for instance, television pictures, unless they were broadcast from trucks. Now, these days, you can basically broadcast from anywhere that you want. It has eliminated a whole slew of people who obviously had worked as engineers, had worked as technicians, a whole bunch of folks. So in terms of the actual physical work environment, it eliminated a lot of what was really sort of the bulky part of broadcasting and communicating. The digital age, though, has changed us dramatically in the sense that it has now created a multiplicity of sources of information that we never had before. Very easy access. For example, if you wanted to say French theory about the world as it was, it were contained in little pamphlets that you might get in the mail or somebody might give you at work. Now it's easy as anything to be able to get those things from the internet automatically, creating virtual crowds. So one of the things I think that's disappeared, but from the 1960s in particular, and the world that McLuhan lived in, was that there was a limited number of sources of information, whether it's newspapers, obviously some radio stations, but also television and the television networks. That has now gone by the wayside. We've seen, obviously, the creation of a whole slew of cable networks, particularly news networks, which have now been divided up into various ideological categories. We now have a new form of information, which is the internet and social media and various websites, which will give you all kinds of information that people can either figure out whether they agree with or not agree with. There's a sort of atomization that's taken place. And the great gatekeepers of the old world, that is the editors, for example, who would vet a story before it even hit the airwave, that person is now basically gone between the person who may produce something on the website or in social media and the person who is now receiving it. Makes the world much more difficult to figure out what is true and what is not. Something like 50%, I saw a poll of Americans, don't know I can't figure out what's true and what's not. They're not sure whether or not what something's being told them is actually accurate. And when asked about, well, what about traditional mainstream media, whether it's networks or the cable, they say, well, everybody does it. So the impact on journalism itself, in terms of traditional journalism, has been that the unreliability of these websites and social media has now permeated into a skepticism about the media in general, and particularly the mainstream. Some of this has obviously been politically developing over years. We have certainly had Spiro Agnew back in the 1970s, who talked about the liberal media, but is now splintered out into sort of a shattering of any kind of controls whatsoever. So that you could be a libertarian, you could be whatever it is, and suddenly you get whatever it is that you want, as opposed to something that's cohesive. So in that sense, I think it's really created a lot of problems, particularly for those folks who are trying to figure out how the world works and what's true and what's not. It's created, I think, a great many problems, which was much different in many ways than certainly when I was getting into it, in which, yes, there were things that were reported that were not true, or the administration would say things that weren't true, and we finally eventually found those out. Now, nobody has any sense about what's true, what's not.
Adam, as a professor, you went through the same transition. Give us a little bit about what it was like to go from what Don mentioned as this analog age into digital technology.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's radically transformed the way that both faculty and students do research. You know, in the old days, you'd have to go and actually be in a library, and you could work only with the sort of physical texts that were there. And if they didn't have those particular books or articles, well, you just worked with something else. But I think it required both faculty and students doing research to really engage with a broader scope of research, right? You had to kind of look into everything that was there to sort of find the information that you were looking for, where, you know, research now is predominantly done on the internet, right? Students very often just start with Google Scholar or something like that. On the one hand, it offers up a lot more information for people to access, right? And so we think, well, that's liberatory, right? That we have access to information in these digital means that is unprecedented in history, right? That you can find any number of things from any number of perspectives. But the reality, I think, for students doing research is that they simply find the first five things that pop up on the internet, and they just sort of build their work around that. And so where it could be one of these things, and I think for some scholars it is still liberating to have that proliferation of information. I think it's also really done away with how research is really done, right? Where we expect instant results, and so we just take the first couple of things that pop up and typically go with that. Now, of course, if you're searching on your home computer knows everything else you've looked at, so it's providing those first five results based on your other interests, right? And so, I think in this sort of way, and this is true of doing any kind of research on the internet, you're being fed particular types of information based on the other things you've looked at before.
Let me ask you, Adam, has it made your work easier or more difficult as an English professor teaching writing and research and literature?
Yeah, for me as a scholar, I think it has made things easier because, again,
You can do the same thing your students do.
Well, right. But I also have access to journals and books that a smaller university like Salisbury University may not normally have, right? And so I have access to virtually every book there's ever been published in some ways. And so, for people doing real research and scholarship, it has really been helpful for a lot of us. Again, I think for students and teaching students, it's more challenging because you really have to push them to try to think beyond what they already believe. They go into doing research and they just want to prove what they already think. And so they're only reading things that reinforce that. And so it's become really challenging. We're going to get to the sort of language at some point, I'm sure, to get students to move out of their own silos to encounter information that is not, sort of in their normal wheelhouse and that they typically resist. And so it really is a challenge in terms of getting students to use that mass volume of information in productive ways.
Well, let's get a little bit into the weeds here. Though, let's not get lost in the weeds, but let's get into what the characteristics of this digital technology are. What are we dealing with here? And I think of things, esoteric things that are crucially important, like binary logic. Who in the world ever understood binary logic? But I think we have someone here at our table who does. So things like binary and algorithms. What in the world? Everything seems to be controlled by algorithms today. What in the world are algorithms? And what are some of the other more weedy aspects of technology, digital technology, that we're dealing with today? And we have Randy Cohn with us today, who is a computer scientist and mathematician. So, Randy, without losing us in the woods, take us through what we're dealing with here in terms of digital logic and digital technology.
From my vantage point, thank you for having me, by the way. From my vantage point, it seems like it's another human cultural change. Things when books were developed, the world changed. Information was distributed in a different way. When the printing press was developed and utilized, it became even more expansive. And that's what we're seeing now. There's a lot of wizardry and magic and mystique that's attached to digital technology sometimes. And it's, in some ways, it's nice and it's fun, but in other ways, it puts up a wall of confusion. So an algorithm, as you asked about earlier, an algorithm really is just a recipe. It's a recipe in that it's a finite number of well-defined steps that has to terminate. The series of steps has to terminate. So that's what an algorithm is. It's a stepwise recipe that's guaranteed to terminate. Now, the time in which it needs to terminate may be really, really long. So it may seem like it would never end, but it's just a stepwise procedure.
What do you mean it has to end, not Randy, and that it may be very, very long and seem like it? What is it doing, this recipe? What are we making with this recipe?
So good question. When we enact these recipes on computers, these algorithms on computers, we're asking them to go through a series of steps. It would be like putting together a piece of IKEA furniture, where we have directions, we have the equipment, we have to do these things one at a time. So there are many screws, so we'll repeat some of these behaviors over and over and over. And if it's a really big desk, it's going to take a while and a lot of repetitive motion. But eventually, if we do this correctly, we follow these steps, it's going to end and we're going to get what we want. So when we go to, say, a weather website, the end result, the things that we're looking at when we're looking at the weather website and we're looking at the weather today in Salisbury, the products that we see on our web browser, the images that were created for us to be able to determine what the temperature or the cloud cover was, all of those things are products, and they're the end chain of these algorithms. So the algorithms need to complete in a finite amount of time so we get that weather map within a reasonable amount of time, but that we're not waiting for these things to happen. So that's what it really is, and that's the primary mechanism of all modern computers, with very few exceptions. So our phones, our desktop computers, our laptops, our tablets, the gas pump, the digital gas pump that we go to, they're all basically the same kind of machine, and they operate on these algorithms, which in their world, for us to make our algorithms work on a computer, we resort to this thing that you referred to called binary logic.
So what is there? What is then the purpose of algorithms that are in my computer, for instance?
So they really are to, most of the time, they're set up to accomplish a certain goal. So the end result of an algorithm is often a computational one. So if we need to figure out multiplying two large numbers on a calculator, well, we have a personal algorithm that we know will work. We enter the first number in. We use, maybe if we're multiplying, we use the multiplication key, and then we type in the other, and then we hit enter. So that is a little algorithm that the behavior that we needed to follow in order to compute those two numbers on a device. So we are using an algorithm to make sure that we're interacting with this device correctly. So that's what's usually happening on your computer as well.
So, can I ask no, you know, Adam, go ahead.
Yeah, the example that you gave, like the weather app, right? When we engage with that, we are willingly engaging with the algorithm, right? We know, I want to know what the weather is in Salisbury today, for example.
Right.
And so we willingly engage with that. But there are thousands, if not millions, of algorithms that we are engaging with that we are not aware of at all.
You know, oh, absolutely.
I think of an email I got a couple of weeks ago from Google saying, here's all the places you visited in the last year, right? And it gave me a map and showed that I'd been in Boston, that I had been in D.C. And I never engaged in this willingly.
That's right. That's right.
The phone is simply monitoring it. Could you talk a little bit about how the unawareness that most people have of how many of these algorithms are they're engaging with every day?
Oh, that's a really good point. So when we're interacting on with the world now via the internet in our browser, advertisers and companies and intelligence agencies have gotten really slick about observing our behavior. So if we go to a certain site, that just gets recorded, and it gets recorded on the server that we visited it, or the intermediate links from a prior source. So if you click on a link, what can happen is that there's an algorithm that you've set off, and that algorithm will do two things. The thing that you know about, which is, well, I hope I follow this link. Mm-hmm. And then there may be chained onto that, unbeknownst to you, a whole series of other things like, well, here, this is how much information we have about this person. Let's record that and let's then sell it to somebody else, or let's keep track of the kind of information that we know they're going to, the site that they intend to visit. So they're watching movement as well. So there's a bunch of these behaviors that are built in. From downloading free PDFs. It feels like a great thing to go and get a free book online that I just found. It may be a Russian site or a Chinese site. It's free, though, so I'm good. I don't have to buy this book. The trouble with that is most of them have these secret algorithms built into those free PDFs. So it feels free, but there's a real cost, because there are a whole series of things that can happen, including you becoming a bot, your computer becoming what is known as a bot or a robot, an autonomous agent for this perhaps malicious group, or perhaps they're just they want to piggyback on your computer, use the power and the resources of your computer to compute passwords to crack another computer. So when we download these things and we think we've gotten away with something, most of the time we haven't.
How do you see this fitting into to what we're seeing politically, the 2016, the hacking, obviously the DNC, right down to micro managing the terms of the individual voters, what their preferences are?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about
that. That is certainly happening, and it's happening on a global scale. We've been doing it. Our industries in the Western world have been doing this to us for a long time, because they want to be able to sell us better. Mm-hmm. They want to be able to convince us of things that we need or we want. Now, that's true, of course, in the political arena as well. And as of two elections ago, it was commonly understood that everyone was profiled. All the U.S. voters were profiled to a significant degree. So think, if that's the case, how much the folks that are in private industry that are gleaning information have about our behavior that they can put together. It's pretty slick. Now here's the interesting thing about information on the internet today. When we had these vetted centers for learning, libraries or universities, and most of the knowledge there, people from around the world or from around cultures would look to those places for vetted knowledge, things that seem to make sense. And we still have that on the internet. And it's, in fact, we have a lot of it, which is great. But all of the junk flyers that were being handed out in front of that library or around the corner now are also in that same place. So we now, when we walk into the internet library, we have not just all the good information that's vetted, we have all these junk flyers laying around. And some of these junk flyers appeal to us and our belief systems, not reality or a factual reality, but our belief systems. So it's easy to manipulate this information in ways that are appealing to people, but not necessarily true. And that's how political, what we're seeing on the political stage.
Well, you hit on it a moment ago, and Don, picking up on your comment, algorithms are one aspect of the digital age that are very crucial. You can correct me, all of you, if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that in one sense, during the agricultural age, the value, wealth, was measured in land. And during the Industrial Revolution and our industrial age, it's kind of was measured in capital, the ability to amass and get money for reinvestment and so forth. Now, it seems that wealth could well be measured in data that is collected, and we're hitting on this aspect of data that all of a sudden Google knows where you've been and what you've done and so forth. Say a little bit about data collection, building on what you've already said about it. And am I right that we get to look at the book online for nothing, but the cost is our data, and what is the data that they collect? I mean, we heard a little already. It's like where we've been, where we go, who we meet with, and so forth. What other kind of data is being collected? And let me mention one other thing in terms of the data aspect, and that is, according to Ramesh Srinivasan, and I apologize for the pronunciation of his name, but his little book, not a little book, his book is called Beyond the Valley, and he talks about who is collecting that data. And there may be a lot of organizations and people collecting data, but he likes to mention who he calls the five big corporations that are, and they are huge, that are collecting data: Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Google, and Facebook. So is he right, and am I right in citing him here, that these are the major data collectors? And what are they doing? What are they collecting, and what are they doing with it?
So I'm on the fence about the data age idea. I think it's wrapped up equally in communication. So who has the ability to communicate effectively to the widest audience? that seems to be where a lot of the wealth is right now. And in that, the collection, if you have that, you have the ability to communicate to a wide range of people, a large number of people effectively. If you have information about them, it prepares you even more. So the kinds of information that you're referring to, it's an amazing amount of information. So a good example is Amazon. I hardly know anyone who hasn't purchased something on Amazon. So when you go to Amazon and you start to browse around, maybe you're browsing around for a gift for your wife or a gift for your friend. All of that browsing, every single thing that you've looked at, whether it was intentional or not, is tracked. And they build a profile about, well, what are your preferences? What are the things that you like? Do you like radical literature? Because you've bought 10 radical books lately. Are you interested in a wide variety of financial information? They will track all of that and watch what your preferences are. And then start to change the internet that you perceive, that you encounter, because some of that information gets stored in a browser. Some of it gets, a lot of it gets stored on the servers around the globe. So that next time you step into the internet waters, if they have perceived the kind of person that they believe you are in your interests, the internet looks different now. That you will see different advertisements. You will see offer different links when you go to Google or to Apple. So you will start to, your perception or your understanding of what's available on the internet is fundamentally altered by the things that you've done in the past.
Does that end up, you know, in sort of listening to you say that, I was thinking about the notion of companies like Amazon taking our desires and turning it into data, right? I desire this thing, right. I desire things like this. And so we might say that it originates from the individual human user, right, expressing a desire. But then Amazon's job in a lot of ways is to feed us that desire back.
That's right.
And
absolutely.
If they are basing it on what we've already looked at, is it really expanding our options or is it limiting them, right? Because you think about Amazon, if you buy something, you know, as soon as you purchase it, it pops up, hey, you might also like this, right? And again, if that's targeted based on our desires, is it in that sort of sense really closing things down by just giving us more of what we've already gotten as opposed to opening us up to other?
And this ties back. What you said is exactly true. I'll tell you how they try to work around that. But this is what we see in social media with political bubbles, that we have a certain political bias or preference oftentimes. And so when we click that we like something, that there was a political ad or a comment made on Facebook by a friend that we agreed with, and we like that. And then we see a meme that we like that seems to agree with our political affiliation. All of that's tracked, recorded, and some oftentimes sold. So that is one of the scariest parts of where we live right now. Is that I'm not as worried about the big companies gathering my data. Facebook is an exception. I'm worried about them, but most of the big companies have a lot of information and they've been gathering it and they've been really slick about it. What I'm worried more about are large corporations whose only job is to gather as much information about everyone they can and every entity they can, businesses and otherwise, and then sell that information. And they will do anything to get that information to sell it. So we're now walking away from legitimate or business acumen and watching what we do. It's like when we go to a store, people watch what we do and what we're looking at, so the salesman can come over and say, hey, I know something about that. Let's talk. That's sort of what some of the bigger businesses are doing. The next tier of purely informational businesses that will do anything they can Cambridge Analytica comes to mind, do anything they can to get information, and they'll sell it to the highest bidder. That is the real worry. The other ones, not as much. There's some worry with social media because there's some really good ones. There's some really there's been some malfeasance in some of these.
Why does Facebook worry you?
Well, they seem to be okay with propagating misinformation and actively allowing it. And there's a certain responsibility with some of these bigger companies to understand when something is not true. It's purposely misleading for often malicious purposes, to allow that to be pushed out on their platform. I think there's a higher level of responsibility with that, but there's a fine line because there's a at least in our country the First Amendment that protects the right for freedom of expression, however nonsensical it is. So Facebook seems to continually fall down on the wrong side of that argument. Twitter and some of the others seem to be doing better.
Is Facebook? Let me ask this in a different way. Who or what companies are active in facial recognition technology? And that's a kind of data that that is collected. For instance, according to some of my reading, people take 1.2 trillion photos by the end of 2017. And there'll be 4.7 trillion photos. And they're generally facial photos stored. And the biggest player is Facebook in that. What are they doing with all of these photos that we post, and does that play into a kind of facial recognition technology?
Yeah, there's some of the as you mentioned, the Facebook is doing it, and they've been doing it a while. Amazon is also doing it, and they're selling large facial recognition systems to countries around the world, sometimes for purposes that are not great. We have some buyers of this technology that want to use it for less than ethical purposes. So it's a complicated issue because what you also are heading toward when we think about facial recognition, the pictures are just part of that. But the recognition is the other part. The picture of the face is the first, but the recognition. Then how do we do that? Well, there are algorithms, and they're just algorithms. And they're just algorithms that are, in this case, fallible because the detail to which we can take digital photographs and then make sense or compare them with each other, it's limited. And oftentimes it's done by neural nets or that kind of artificially intelligent, as it's called, technologies. Now, those are algorithms too, and they're processes that are finite and they're guaranteed to terminate to create a neural net or an artificial intelligence that even a deep neural net that's in working with photographic technology to try to make sense or compare them. See if we see this person is the same person, the facial recognition. And the DARPA knows this well, the Defense Advanced Research Projects. They know well that these neural nets, these algorithms, are very fragile. They seem like they'll do so much, and they're so useful, but they're really fragile. There's a famous experiment by DARPA where they took their most advanced neural net, and they fed it lots of pictures of animals over and over and over, so it was learning the animals. They took a picture of a panda, and it was a digital image, and you can change that image by just tweaking a knob a little bit. You can change it by 0.5%. So it's an imperceptible change to a human to look at that same photograph. So you have the original picture of the panda, and you have the slightly altered version, the digitized, slightly altered version that a human wouldn't be able to tell the difference looking at the two. You take that really slightly altered digital photograph, put it into the neural net. They did this, and instead of saying it was a panda, they said it was a monkey. So this is the most advanced neural net capable, at least at the time of that experiment, of about 5 years ago. And it didn't, so that's a fragility, right? Statistically, it performs pretty well across all the animals, but it doesn't take much in just the right direction to break it completely.
Well, I understand that's also a problem with facial recognition technology, because there have been experiments, and some people are defined as to some degree not people in terms of the facial recognition, or you have an algorithm that looks at all these faces and decides that if they're a white blonde woman, they must be intelligent or some other characteristic. So talk for just a moment, and Don and Adam as well, about the biases. If there are biases, because these algorithms are created by human beings, and we all have biases. What role do biases play in both facial recognition technology that you've mentioned, and also in the kind of normal algorithms that are used?
Yeah, I mean, I think Brandon probably could speak better to this, but when we think about the algorithm is just something that does what it's told, right? That there is not an, there's not a, the algorithm is not biased. Right, the algorithm simply does what it does, but that we have this sort of sense that whoever is creating the algorithms, if they are approaching with a particular bias, right, then the algorithm has no choice but to produce that information. Right, I mean, a sort of simple, you know, sort of thought experiment is if you typed in just on Google crime photos, right. You may get a sort of random assortment of crime photos, but if you are of the belief that, say, black Americans commit more crimes, and you type in black American crime photos, it will give you just those, right? The algorithm itself is simply giving you what you asked for, but it also is allowing that algorithm to reinforce a biased perspective, right?
Right.
Are most people, do you think, really aware of that structure, right? Because, you know, you hear people sort of wanting to blame the algorithms. In some ways, oh, the algorithm is doing this. Well, no, it's created, but it's also how you are interacting with it that makes it get to that endpoint that you're talking about.
Absolutely. The nature of these artificially intelligent agents or tools that we're using, the nature of them they will only learn from the information that we give them. That's the nature of almost all of these technologies in today's world. So if you feed them a bunch of this information that you want to be true, then of course that's what it's going to learn. Right. And it will be implicitly biased.
Right. It seems to me, as you talk particularly about the facial recognition, in the United States, for instance, they've done studies where when we had a number of shootings involving African Americans, and they did a study. They said, okay, so here's a black person and who looks like he has something, and here's a white person who has something, right? And so they did this. They said, well, so who do you think this person has a weapon, or don't you? What was interesting about the study was that first and foremost, African Americans were more identified to have a weapon than, say, the white person. But that bias was across racial lines, i.e. that an African-American saw the same thing. That, I mean, we were talking about pattern recognition, which is really, I think, what you were talking about. We get around in the world very easily with that, because that's how we get around. We can't, you know, you can't redefine a chair every time you see it. You instantly know it. And it seems to me that with this kind of artificial intelligence, it's only it's having a harder time than what we have in terms of recognizing how the world works and what patterns there are out there. Do you think that at some time point down the line, that these kinds of machines will become as sophisticated, for instance, in terms of pattern recognition, be able to discern the world around it, as, for instance, human beings are, even with their flaws?
So I don't doubt that eventually that will be the case. I don't think that we have the technology now, at least in any public, with any public knowledge, that we have such technology. But I teach an artificial intelligence class at Salisbury University. And we talk a lot about intelligence for the better part of the first half of the semester, and then we play around with games to create artificially intelligent agents to do successfully more difficult problems. And it becomes really clear really quickly that with algorithms, even with neural nets and these statistical machine learning algorithms, that these stepwise procedures are extraordinarily limited, right? So the fact is, when we're, as a human, we learn something. Say we learn how to play baseball, and we spent several years playing baseball. Well, if we were to take go and start to play cricket or another sport, some of those things that we learned, the hand-eye coordination, are transferable. We're able to go over and take part in a different skill set, that we have the ability to abstract these things that we have to do in order, and then move them to a different domain. We do this intellectually all the time. That's the thing that modern intelligence, artificial intelligence, can't do. So we can teach it to learn about one set of information really, really, really well, and it will statistically perform well. It will break. It will be really fragile on small instances, but statistically it will do really well. But we can't take that same black box that figured out that problem and use it to solve another problem. Whereas you and I could work on one problem and learn things from it and apply those techniques to a totally different problem. Modern artificial intelligence doesn't have the ability to abstract or to be autonomous in the ability to say, I can work on this and then work on this, and I can do a whole bunch of different things in very general, flexible terms. Well, why would you do this naturally?
Why do you think that is?
What is it that
makes the difference between this biological machine which we have, right?
Right.
As opposed to this non-biological, artificial, I mean, Is there such a fundamental difference that it will never achieve what the biological machine...
So here's a really interesting thing that's happened culturally over the last 70 years, and John von Neumann made this metaphor about the human brain, and he was working on circuitry to create the first neural nets and to think about artificial intelligence. And this was in the 40s and 50s, and past that. But he used the analogy, the brain is like a machine. Mm. And that's what now we do all the time. We're always now comparing ourselves and our abilities to machines as if we were a machine also. Well, the neuroscience doesn't indicate that. We are far from these binary machines, binary logical machines. We are so much more than that. The animal life, the plant life on this planet is so much more than that. So much deeper and more profound types of intelligences than just being able to decide yes or no a bunch of times in a row, which is what a computer can do really well. So we have this finite machine that can only do stepwise recipes. And we're that is the kind of machine that we're talking about. It's almost like a calculator. It's a stepwise machine. Even though they do a lot of things really fast in today's world, these computers, it's still just a finite machine that can take a finite number of steps, make a finite number of binary decisions. That's incredibly limiting relative to what we can do.
Let me ask let me shift the gears, our gears a little bit here, you're hitting on it a bit, Randy, the difference here, but can we attribute, to what degree can we attribute any ethics or any ethical direction to digital technology? And let me ground that just a little bit. There's a lot of argument, and I opened with it with the McLuhan piece, that digital technology may well be a hot medium. And a hot medium, according to McLuhan, at least back in the 60s, is a medium that separates us, that individualizes us, and is not beneficial to collectivity. How does that, is that accurate? Do you sense that is happening? And if so, how? And another way of saying that is, are we, and I don't mean to sound draconian here or anything, but are we manipulated by current digital technology in terms of social media, the computer, the algorithms, the data collection, and the whole ball of wax?
When you were talking about that, and when Randy was speaking just a minute ago, I was thinking of some of the stories that you hear about young people, predominantly young men, who sort of get radicalized on YouTube, for example, right? That they will start out watching one video that, let's say, is, you know, leaning to the right politically. And then in the next suggestions, it suggests a video that's even further in that direction, right? And then so they watch that. The next one is even further in that direction. And so you can start looking at something that may just be sort of Republican, but you go through a handful of videos and you end up sort of veering into alt-right territory, neo-Nazi territory. And I'm sure that this works for the left as well. The algorithm is doing that in some ways, but it's also doing that based on other user information, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can look up a song and it will, YouTube will suggest, here are songs that sound similar, or people who like this band also listen to this. Right. And that seems innocuous enough. But when we think about that sort of acceleration, right, that some of these algorithms seem almost designed to have that acceleration, even ideologically, is that just an accident where it's going off of user input, or is it fundamentally built into that algorithm?
So that's a good question. So the place that we arrive at in this artificial intelligence course that I teach over at SU, the place that we arrive at in the last month of the semester is that most students, after experiencing the technology that's at hand and trying to develop new technology in this class as well, to go beyond the current boundaries, the ideas and the things that we're working on, the students understand that it's limited and that we don't have to worry about autonomous robots coming and taking over the world, that this artificial intelligence is going to spontaneously become autonomous and we'll have Terminator. What we do arrive at instead of that, which is fun and interesting and it makes a lot of nice fiction, but it's not reality. The thing that we have to really be worried about is that some clever people using artificial intelligent technology that can do some small things really well, to use that. So humans using the technology for malicious purposes against other humans or the planet. So it's we don't have to worry about autonomous intelligence agents coming or spontaneously becoming autonomous. We don't have to worry about that. What we have to worry about is clever humans using artificial intelligence against other humans. So a good example of this is that the AI technology and modern algorithms allow a videographer to take a clip, a digital clip of somebody, say, maybe giving a speech. And then you can use algorithms to make them say things, patch up the video feed to make it seem like they're saying something else and make their mouth move as if they're really mouthing the words.
Sort of deep fake phenomenon.
Deep fake, right. Exactly. So that's the kind of thing that we need to worry about, because that is being done, and it's being done on a regular basis in ever more sophisticated ways. So that it does all of these things, but in human culture, there have always been these nefarious sort of agents around. But we see the better side of this too with that digital technology, because the GoFundMe, when somebody can't pay their medical bills, or their wife just died, or all kinds of different circumstances, maybe they have new technology they want to share with the world, but they don't have the money to start it. So we see all of these great opportunities for people to come together in new ways. I worked with a bunch of people at an international conference on mathematics recently. We ended up gathering a bunch of food and money and resources for the local homeless while we were at that conference. So that this was the way that we did that is we communicated using text, using social media, using email. So thousands of people who were at a conference use the power of modern digital technology to do something better for a community that they were just visiting. And so those kinds of things can happen. So there is this interconnectedness. But as in all human affairs, there's also this fracturing that's happening too. As things change, as human culture changes, we watch this expansion and contraction, this dissolution and together recombining over and over. I'm hoping that's what we'll see, is that this is going to balance out.
Do you think that we're seeing a sort of reorganizing social relationships because we can, say, for instance, stretch across, obviously, people all around the world in terms of the people that we, for instance, may agree with or be part of? Is society, do you think, rearranging itself in terms of beliefs, as opposed to, say, for instance, if you lived, for instance, in a small village, you had to deal with all kinds of people who may or may not agree with? In the old technology, if you only had three networks, you were exposed to information that you may not like to see. Or the old newspapers, the rise of newspapers, you were exposed to things that perhaps you would not be exposed to unless you were in that form. But now it seems as if you have a certain fragmentation that takes place, a reorganization, as it were, of society. I mean, do you think that's happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You know, when the sort of internet first really began, you know, people talked about the ability to engage with people from around the world who thought different things and believed different things, and that, you know, we would be exposed to all these sorts of things. That is technically possible. But again, it seems that the algorithms are designed to give you yourself back very often, right? And so what, again, has the potential for very positive revolutionary change, right? I think of the example Randy gave, or you can think about the Arab Spring, right, which would have been impossible without this sort of technology, seems very often to simply connect people with people who seem just like them, who believe just like them, right? And so that you don't end up with discourse, right? Differing ideas, differing perspectives, differing ideologies coming together to hammer things out, as much as it is, well, I think this, here's this group globally that also thinks that, right? And so, again, you know, we do have this sort of sense, you know, it's almost like Marx said about, you know, the Industrial Revolution, you know, capitalism, it gives us the best and the worst at the same time. Is there a way, though, to work to limit those sort of negative aspects? Or is the cat just sort of out of the bag on that? Is that just something that we now have to simply accept is part of things? Can we set limitations at this point, given the how rapidly this technology has developed?
I hate to do this, but our time is... we do have... three more broadcasts,
that's right,
though, in the future that we can, don't lose that question.
Well, thankfully it's recorded, so yeah.
Adam, that's right. I'm going to have to call time on us, please. And so, Don and Adam and Randy, thank you very much for a fascinating and entertaining discussion. I certainly appreciate it greatly. We are truly in the midst of a great global cultural revolution that has an impact, as we've seen, on everyone. So we want to look in the future at what is the impact on our economy, and that will be our next discussion. In a couple of months, the impact of the digital age and the economy, and then on our politics, what is the impact of digital technology on our politics, and then more on artificial intelligence and where we're going. But I think also where we're going in terms of the morals that are associated with digital technology. We are in this, I call it this digital soup that offers huge, huge benefits, as well as some dire threats to us. And I think the primary question that lingers over all of this is, how do we create and implement public purpose goals for digital technology that are designed to support and nurture human communities and actually to foster the wholeness, the empathy, and the depth of awareness that McLuhan anticipated in his age. Thanks again to all of you, and thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.